Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everyone. Glad you all came. Welcome to my experiment. I hope you will all find it enjoyable. Is anybody here at the workshop that I gave last year? I don't remember, last year, 2 years ago? No one. Okay, so I really should have reversed it. I gave a workshop. This is, for me, part of a... this is a two-part class, but I have two parts to the workshop that I have been working on. And the first one, this is actually the second. So I was sort of assuming that people who came to the first one would come to the first one. So I started with the second one, and I'm doing the first one in January. So if I would have realized, I would have reversed it, but it's too late now. So we're just going to jump right into part two. Let me give you a little bit of background as to what I was trying to create in this workshop, of which none of which you were at the first part, which is totally fine. We'll pick in right and pick up, and then you'll see that they're two totally separate issues. But I just want to explain where I'm coming from so you'll see what I'm trying to accomplish, and then you can even tell me at the end whether or not it worked, or if it didn't work, and I'll be very happy to hear your feedback. Who here has been to a marriage class, lecture, chizur, shalom bayit, something or another? I imagine it's just everywhere. So I've been to many, many, many speeches, lectures. I've listened to tapes or CDs. They're all very good, the ones that I've been to. Speakers are excellent, better than me, have lots of information. And I find that by the time I'm home, after having listened to the lecture, most of whatever I got is lost. While it's beneficial to hear over and over and over again, but it's hard to sometimes take sometimes one of the two of the spouses go. They're good, and I always felt myself personally lacking. So it occurred to me after having been to one or two different types of things that once you actually have people in the room, actually do the work right then and there on the spot. So that I actually tried to create a workshop, which hopefully you come back to in January. That part is really all about getting to know each other. And I know that everybody knows each other. I know you think that there are specific tools that we would use to bring out different parts of people's personalities that we would do activities. I would speak very little. Everybody would be doing different things, each other amongst different couples. And it was successful. I've done that up in New York already, once in a shul, and it's a lot of fun. So the reason why this is only $18 and not $36 is because since you're my trial on the new material, which I've never done before, so I'm giving you all a break. But when I make it big, then you'll be like, oh wow, we got in before. It was still only $18. So this is an experimental session. This is new material for me. I've done the other material a bunch of times, and I've worked it through. I'm really very happy with it, and this is going to be the first time going through this material. So you let me know how it goes. That's enough of the background. What I wanted to focus on with this session, this week and the next Tuesday night, is conflict, dealing with different aspects of conflict, different resolution, understanding it, different ways that we respond to it, and it's a natural, inevitable part of marriage. It's impossible to take two people from two different backgrounds who grew up in two different homes, and you put them together and think that they're going to agree on everything. It's silly to think that. It's impossible that that should be true. It was never meant to be that way, and therefore, it's a part of life. It's a part of our existence. And so I wanted to work on a bunch of different aspects of this from my own experiences that I've culled from my own life in which it played such a role, and then sort of try to put them together and share it. At the end of the day, it's really very simple. Marriage is all about being a nice guy. And the story, everybody can go home. That's really what it's all about. Every time we have it, just figure that out and do it. The problem is actually making that happen. So what I want to do, and what the plan is, which is coming out, I was successful, to actually go through a bunch of different tools and skills that you'll actually both do tonight. And then we'll see, take it from there. Next week is going to be a lot heavier work. I want to work on some other things. This will be the build-up. This will do tonight for what Mirza Shem will accomplish, what we'll accomplish next week. Most of the things that I'm going to say tonight, you'll say to yourself, I knew that already, or that's obvious, which is fine. My goal isn't that you walk out of here saying I learned new things, but that I walked out of here and I feel more equipped to actually use them when they happen and when they come up in our existence. Let me just start with something which I'm borrowing from the other session. Is it called Shiftsmahina? I'm is anyone here going to admit that they're cold? Ever close your eyes and put your ears in a direction? I'm fine. I know. I'm fine. Yeah, I set it at like 55 degrees, waiting to see if anyone is going to admit that they're actually called. But if you're comfortable, then it's fine with me. I don't mind. Okay, just to borrow one little thing that I used from the other session, I have a little piece that I like to do my introvert-extrovert discussion. So some of you who just looked in were at my last session, but I'm going to do this anyway, just as an intro to what we're going to do, Mr. Shem, tonight. So most of you are familiar with the terms introvert and extrovert. So when I was in graduate school, I learned a new way of defining the term introvert and extrovert. I've actually looked it up, and it is a valid explanation. I find it to be very enlightening. Introverts and extroverts both can be extremely adept in social settings. The major difference, as I'm going to define it, is whether or not you put forth energy in a social setting or whether or not you draw energy from a social setting. So, for example, I'm a major introvert, which means that when I'm in a social setting, I'm putting forth energy. I am actively involved extrovert.
No.
Introvert. That's correct. I'm an introvert. An introvert has to put forth energy in a social setting. So that when I'm schmoozing with someone at Kiddush, I feel that I'm giving to this relationship. I have to actively, okay, the conversation is going to go like this, it's going to go like that, and I'm giving. My wife, who's an extrovert, draws energy from being around people, and you see it in an extrovert, like when they like walk into the room. Look at all these people, and it's like exciting. And you start talking and schmoozing, and you walk into a room exhausted, but you walk out bouncing off the wall because there's just so much activity, and it's exciting, and you draw energy from that. So I, at the end of Shabbos davening, and then Kiddush, and then my Shabbos lunch, if we're hosting, by the time that period comes, I am finished. I have given everything that I have to give. If it's 3:30, I'm done. I physically don't have what it takes to continue another conversation because I have to give to be in a social setting, and I'm out. I need to recharge. Has an introvert recharged? I'm alone, sleep, quiet time. I yearn for that because I need that to physically recharge my battery. An extrovert that has the exact opposite experience. The more the people around, it's great. It's just drawing energy. They want to recharge. If they're exhausted and tired, if an extrovert at the end of a long Shabbos is really tired, and you say, let's stay home together, just the two of us. Like, that's horrible. Like, alone, quiet of the house. Like, I'm going out of my skin. I need to be with people because that's actually how I recharge. Now, there's nothing wrong or right about either one. It's just a reality as to how we respond to different people. Most people will look at me and say, you're not an introvert, you're an extrovert, because I spend my day in the public eye. So you think, but I don't use the definition of being either good, which you can reserve judgment if I am good, if I'm not good. I don't mind, that's fine either way. I'm telling you, when I'm in public, I'm giving energy. And my wife is drawing energy, which means that we have a conflict every Moshe Shabbos, because every Moshe Shabbos, I want to be by myself, and she wants to go out, because we're both tired. And we respond to being tired in very different ways. I respond to being tired by being by myself. My wife responds to being tired by wanting to go out. This creates a major problem if she makes plans for us on those shows. And the reason why I share this, I'll take a quick, let me stop here. Take a quick, speak to yourself for a second. What I like to do is, as I'm speaking, when it stops, and that's why I set the room this way, and you speak to each other, I'm not interested in anything that you guys have to say tonight. I mean, a little bit I am, but I'm not going to hear anything that you're saying tonight. But you're going to speak to each other about each thing as we go along. Some of them will be like 30-second things. Some of them will be 5 minutes. But the point is just to sort of engage that. So just amongst yourselves, some of you have been ribbing each other. The reason why I love whenever I speak about this, I already can tell. Like 80% are already ribbing each other as I'm speaking. Because 90%, I've done this in four different settings, and I've asked this question. And easy, over 80%, I think it's up to 90, couples are intermarried when it comes to this, where we're not always one way or another, but most of us feel pretty clearly identifiable in one way versus another, and 90% of couples are intermarried, so to speak, when it comes to this regard in terms of introvert. So clearly just amongst yourselves, just how you would define yourselves in general, and we'll give a situation where this manifests itself in a funny way for the two of you. All right, I'm going to cut this one short because I have a lot of things to do. So let me just quick show of hands. How many of you would identify yourselves as an intermarried couple? How many of you other couples would say for sure you're the opposite? A little more than half, but not that much more than half. How many of you couples would I clearly identify themselves as being an opposite when it comes to this? The one just like, it's a million. Now the way that this manifests itself in many, many different ways, for example, just two quick examples and we'll move on. when Rivka and I go to dinners or functions, bar mitzvahs, weddings here in shul, because we live so close to the house we can do this, we take two cars. Because towards the end of the event, I am finished. I am done. I'm not interested in being there. I'm thinking about what I have to do the next day. I've already been through a whole day, and I need some quiet time or else I'm going to collapse. My wife has finally got out of the house. And now look at all these people. There's so many people to talk to. And so what happens is, otherwise, I'm sitting at the whole time. And she's like, what are all these people? So instead of us both going home miserable, either because I dragged her out before she was done, or because I ended up there for 30 minutes longer than I wanted to be, and I am not happy about it, we bring two cars. And when I'm done, okay, I'll see you at home. She says, great. We both get home 45 minutes later, and we're both happy. I'm holding her trunk, it's been quiet, I got to take care of some stuff, she got the schmutz, and we are much better, we are the much better for it. And I said this when I was up in New York, and it looked like I was crazy, because in New York, my missus are 45 minutes away from home, like you live in Queens and you have to travel to Brooklyn. They were like, that doesn't work. But here it does, and it's a totally fine thing. The other place where it manifests itself is when we do have plans on a Moshe Shabbos, let's say she makes plans to go somewhere. So if there's no end of that evening, like if we go out and it's just like we're going out with so-and-so, wherever we're going, and this happened to us, which is why I'm sharing this, I know this as a realist example, I can muster what it takes if I know, like, okay, we're leaving at 8, at 10 o'clock it's over. But sometimes you have these events where there's no end, and when you walk in at, like, the tank is just about empty and it's interminable, like there's, like, you don't know what's coming next. So it's a disaster for people like me. So, but if you know each other, and the extrovert says, we make plans, we have plans, this is the plan. We'll make a compromise. We're going for, I can handle it as long as you keep your end of the bargain, and we leave when we need, or the extrovert, you know, sometimes the extrovert has to stay home for the introvert. It's manageable, but the idea is when you understand each other, and you know what's going on, you have terms to describe each other's feelings, it's much easier to handle. You have a question?
Well, you're both saying you're getting contrary to your personality. She should be out talking to people and you should be her full friend.
No, but, so that's
the thing. She wants to get out because she hasn't seen anybody and you want to go home and all you do is see people. So yes. People should maybe do what they're more comfortable with.
But that doesn't, I'm just saying I'm not comfortable with what I'm doing. It doesn't mean I don't love what I'm doing. It just means at the end of the day I'm tired. Yes. I happen to very much enjoy what I'm doing and I don't want to do anything else. It just means that I'm tired at the end of the day. I put forth energy to do what I do. But I wouldn't tell somebody to do something else just because it just means that I have to invest in what I'm doing, which is fine. I don't mind doing that, and I think most of us invest in what we do for a living. So it's not a problem. It just means that we're going to be tired at the end of the day. No, I have personally found it completely gender neutral in terms of how it works. And as yeah, I have found it completely gender neutral in terms of who is which way. It makes no difference whatsoever. It's just the way they did it. When couples are both introverts, you never see them. Those are the couples like, I haven't seen them in like 4 months. Where'd they go? Because they're so happy being at home. They like, they go to school, they run home, and they're happy. They're not complaining that no one ever sees them and they don't see anyone. But and it's fine. It's only fair if one of the two is more extroverted, then that becomes a problem. They get to figure that out, which is fine, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. But I have found it to be gender neutral. Yeah.
You find this especially in religious Judaism where there's so many shabbosim and chagim and so forth where these couples will have different views about entertaining and about going out, we're just staying home.
Yeah.
I,
the reason I shared, I love this little piece that I'm talking about now because the world we live in is so social-centric in terms of every Shabbos and Yom Tov and meals and these affairs, bar mitzvahs and weddings. It's very much involved in that. And for some people, it's fabulous. For some people, it's a disaster. And everybody has to figure out a manual. But when you have the terms to go home and say, I really need a Shabbos alone this week, I get it. If I say that to my she'll get it because she's usually in charge and is always busy and every once in a while I need some quiet time. And it's not like why? I get it because we have different words. One of my goals for tonight is just to give terminology to understand things that you already know about yourself. In other words, as I was talking, you guys are ripping each other. I'm not saying anything you don't know about each other. I'm just putting a word on it to say, like, oh, this defines the whole personality. I get it. Like, this is why at weddings, at a certain point, you just go home. I get it. And this is why I like to stay. And so when you have terminology, it's just as helpful in figuring those things out. Now, my point in using this as an introduction, besides the fact that I think it's so much fun, is we don't choose to be the way that we are. That's the way that it is. I get tired in social settings, and my life gets energy from social settings. It's the way the Ribbono Shel Olam made it. That's how it is, and we just sort of deal with that. So when we talk about, as what we're going to be discussing tonight, the concept of dealing with conflict, dealing with different approaches, that's the first step, is just understanding that we are inherently different. So the next step that I want to take as we just get into this a little bit is a section that I like to call, there's honey in the cholent. Now, cholent, as you know, comes in lots of different flavors. You can put lots of different things in cholent. You can leave lots of things out from cholent. And depending on how you like it, you will have various different ingredients. Some people like to put sweet potatoes in the cholent. Some people think that's a disaster. How could you put a sweet potato in a cholent? Some people like to put honey. Some people don't like to put honey in barbecue sauce. You name it, it's out there. What do you do in a situation in which, I'll ask the men, this will be our next little activity, men are going to have to answer the following question. And I'll be the wise in this particular instance asking you the question, and you come and answer this question. You're married for however long you're married, doesn't really make a difference. Your wife starts cholent. And you discover there's honey in the cholent. But you don't really know what it is. But you know that when you taste it, something is wrong with this cholent. Because cholent is supposed to have a meat and potato type of taste. And this is, there's like something wrong with the cholent. And you're not sure what it is, but it's wrong. It's off. It just doesn't taste the way you think cholent is supposed to taste. Sitting at the Shabbos table, and you have a bite or two, force yourself to have three or four, but like that's it. Here's the exercise. Wives, turn to your husbands. So, what do you think of the cholent? And all your husbands can right now try to figure out how are you going to answer that question. You could take a moment and let me know how you felt.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Did she also change the recipe?
Yeah, something new. Something new. Or it's the first time your first job is together and this is the first cholent she's ever served. And you can't, it's just like, it's no good. however you want to do that stuff. Okay, what's the inherent problem with this? What's your answer? You're caught. This is a trap. Why is this a trap? Correct. Nothing. The trap is, let's just spell it out because this is really important to talk about.
When in doubt, lie.
So here's the trap. In other words, that's one approach. When in doubt, lie. So you say, it's delicious. Now that's obviously going to be problematic because what happens if you say that? She's going to get it next week and you don't like it. You don't like it. I simply don't like it. I don't even know that it's honey, but I know there's something in here that's bad. So when is that why? All right. Not if it's going to be every week, because next week you're going to get it. Now, what's the other option?
Tell the truth.
This is horrible. Right? Yeah.
It's looking the recipe.
Okay. So I want to set up the trap because it's actually very important because this happens all the time. This is like regular my single cholyom, everyday activities. And how was it? I don't care if I say it was good. I'm stuck. I'm gonna be stuck with this forever. My mother-in-law, until we're married 13 years now, until about 3 or 4 years ago, would buy a huge jug of apple juice every single time I would be coming for Shabbos. I can't stand apple juice. I have not had a cup of apple juice since I was about 5 years old. The first time I walked into my mother-in-law's house to pick up my wife, she offered me two things. I don't know, whatever it was. I wasn't interested in either, but apple juice. I got apple juice in big containers
for years. Because that's what I said. And now it's like, oh, you must like apple juice. And she wants to be a good mother. Well, if I get Allie. About 10 years later, we finally had a conversation. And I really don't like, I have not had a couple of doctors since I was 5. But that's why I got separate. You know, none of us want to get separate out in our marriages because we want our children to be the way we like it. And the other problem is that the wife really wants to make a choice that her husband likes. She's not interested in making something that he doesn't like. But how do we deal with the situation? So the reason, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, this is like a trap. You would just say that this children thing is differently than the one
you've made. Let's assume this was your first time then, just to keep it straightforward. Let's assume this is the first time she makes children, you're newlywed. How do you like it?
You're changing
everything. Whatever. Sometimes when it's different, even if it's different, how would you dress it when it's something new?
What's the question?
So it's just it's different. So you used to like it before, now it's new. How do you like it?
So I would actually totally be honest, right? And at the same time, I'll make my wife smaller. I just say that I would first need to understand what is it about it that I don't like. If it's depressing, then you could just say, like, I think I like A, B, and C, and, I prefer things that are not that spicy. And she's not wrong,
right? She's not wrong, and that's the fine answer. What I want to bring, the reason why I think this is a step one is, the reality is, if none of you felt that it's a trap, that's great. Most men, I think, would feel trapped in that situation, because they're not really sure how to handle it. Because if it's a change, it's a lot easier. If it's not a change, if it's the first time making a dish, like, what do? You say it's terrible, I don't like it at all, or do you say I like it, I'm going to get it again. The reality behind it, and the point that I want to bring out, is to leave you with the phrase, honey in the choice. Because I have a sweet tooth, so my wife knows that, and she bakes cakes all the time because I have a sweet tooth. So she would naturally assume a guy like me with a sweet tooth is going to like honey in the choice. Because the choice, not like cake. Cake should be sweet, choice should be meat, potato-y. That's just the way that it is for me. So I leave you with the phrase, and you can come up with any one that you want. You can call it sweet potato in the choice, you can call it cumin in the choice, you can call it whatever, you know, honey in the choice. What it means is I have a different taste. When you were dating, if you go out to the ice cream store, and one of you buys vanilla, and the other one orders strawberry, no one on a date would say, strawberry? You like strawberry ice cream? That's disgusting. Well, no one would say that because it's okay. I'm allowed to like vanilla. You like my choice. It's not offensive to me that you don't like the flavor of ice cream that I like. They're different flavors. They're different tastes. Sometimes what happens, again, this is just step one, is when we have differences, is remembering that it's an introvert-extrovert thing. It's a honey and the showing kind of thing. There are actually just, we have natural differences. It's a trap only if in that scenario, if the wife will take it personally that her husband doesn't like the dish. That's when it's a trap. Your married tenacious Kyle is not going to take it personally. She's going to say, you don't like the things that I cook. That's fine. You like me. You don't like my food. But we take things, and this is where it's worth mentioning, because very often we take things very personally. Whether or not it's the wife making a dish or it's the husband fixing something around the house, and you just didn't do it the way that, or hanging up pictures, which was a great one. Like, how am I supposed to know exactly how she wants the picture framed? She wanted a vertical one, like, see it or not, I don't know, I did my best.
You're just supposed to know, man.
Right, and I didn't know, I messed it all up, and it's all wrong. So very often, things which should not be taken personally are interpreted that way, and we're going to do that to why. And it's important just to be aware and be able to have a phrase in mind to say, How do you like this? How do you like that? Where you can say, if you don't have to use my honey in the chill example, that's worse than my house, you can come up with whatever it is that says, you know, pistachio ice cream. I like it and you don't. Something personal. I love you. And it's a starting point to addressing many things and avoiding traps. If both parties are aware of that, if the wife or husband, whichever situation it is, knows to be aware not to take things personally, it is helpful. Why do we take them personally? I use this as a stepping stone. Why do we take things so personally? So I want to introduce a concept that I've come across, and then we'll use this to move into our next steps. There's a book written by a woman, Dr. Sue Johnson is her name. She wrote a book called Hold Me Tight. Judy Spear gave me this book. It's a fascinating approach. And her theory in marriage is as follows. I spoke to her about this, and I'll share a Ramban with you on this also. Her approach that she has for the concept of marriage is a very simple one, and when I read it, very, very powerful. She believes the concept of marriage, the union that's created, is an emotional bond. Sounds very simple. Let me explain it as doing my best understanding of what she's explaining. We very often don't think of marriage this way, but it is. If you've been married, you've experienced the fact that offenses, mistakes that we make, words that we should say, shouldn't say, that we should have said, that we didn't say, whatever it happens, often are received in ways far greater than what should inherently be valid. Like if you look at this instance and you would say, what just took place? What just took place is husband X made a mistake and said Y, which he shouldn't have done. How bad is that on a scale of like 1 to 100? Where would we place this particular offense? Let me put it somewhere in the low 20s. Yet the reaction that you get, you would have thought that you're in like the 80s. Like the coldness, the response, the like, how could you, what, like now, what, like you could just sense whenever that happens in the house, like the whole environment like drops like 0 or 5 degrees immediately, and you're like, oh, again, like you have that feeling, it was so small, and like, come on, is the reaction that I find myself thinking all the time. Like, why? Like, it doesn't happen at work. We're like able to like move past this very quickly. I do this all the time. I'm not like any worse at home than I am at work. I make mistakes in both places. And when I make them at home, you think I'm stepping on these landmines. Why is that? And the reality is, she describes, because marriage is an emotional bond. And she bases herself, it's a very interesting approach, she bases herself on the psychologist John Bowlby, who has a very famous piece of attachment theory, that children, he's talking about parents and children, that there's a very strong bond that's formed between children and parents. And when that bond is not there, with closeness, with touch, with that feeling of an environment of nurturing, then children don't develop well, and they need to have that sense of closeness. I'm saying over the whole theory in one sentence. Her point is that a marriage is the same way, and whether we admit it or not, and most of the times we don't, we are extremely dependent, in a healthy way, dependent for emotional stability, support, nurturing, confidence in our spouse. And we look to our spouse for those things in a way that we generally won't admit readily, but if you think about it, We do. We completely depend on the confidence that we get from our spouse. When our spouse is complimentary, when they tell us that they're so proud of us, that they stand behind us, they support us emotionally, physically, in every way, that gives us our hope, literally. Literally is the basis of what we stand upon. And when that's not there, when a marriage is in trouble, and the couples don't feel that from each other in life, they're like wafting away, they're waving the water. They're unanchored because of the support that we actually need. It's a shelter. And what happens is when we feel that threatened, we give out a primal scream, so to speak, except we don't actually scream, but we respond in other ways that are the equivalent of that primal, like, uh-oh, I'm not safe. I'm not secure. And it's like almost like a tightrope. And if you pluck a tightrope and someone's walking on it, there's a lot of wavering that goes along. You know, it's a small little, I didn't think very much, I just plucked it. But if that's what you're holding on to, the reverberations are very, very strong. And my personal experience when I read how she was describing this and all the case studies that she's been involved, like, this shit just makes sense, because when you do something, it's not about what you said or didn't say. It's really not about that. It's not about that you forgot to pick up an image you forgot about. It's that this relationship is so significant, so critical to my well-being. When you do something that I can see as an affront, as a threat to that stability, I go into protection mode. Or I go into a needy mode, because I need to hear from you that it's not really the way that it's seeming right now, because it seems like you don't care, or that you're not here, you're not responsive, you're not available, and I don't know what to do with that. So I get very, very hurt when you reject me, even though the rejection is not so great. But when it's an actual rejection, once again, I said to you, when it's an actual rejection, one spouse has actually asked the other spouse for something, whether or not it's time, it might be intimacy, it might be whatever it may be, and there's a rejection, I'm not interested. However that rejection looks, that cuts to the core. We respond to that like, we're so hurt. And it's based on this primal fear of now what happens because of this, and I need to feel that sense of security. So I read this, I thought it sounded right. I was like, is there a place in Chazal for this? Like, if she's saying this so strongly, where is that? So I found, I was looking around, I thought, where was the very first pasuk that describes marriage in the Torah? The very first time the Torah describes marriage, defines what it is. Al ken yaazov ish et aviv ve'esimo, a man should therefore leave his mother and his father, v'zovach v'ishto, and cling to his wife, v'hagi v'bosir echad, will become one. So the Ramban understands that a man should leave his mother and his father, the closeness of the relationship that he has with his mother and his father, and replace that with the relationship of his wife, and in the Ramban's words, and the relationship with his wife is a closer one than he had with his parents. So that all of the support that he had from his parents and the nurturing, you leave that, and it then gets transferred. I no longer get that from my parents. Children, their lifeblood is from us as parents providing the nurturing environment. And then we get up, we can grow up, we get married, and it's not that we're independent. I don't need my parents, I don't need their support, I don't need their nurturing, I don't need their encouragement, I don't need their confidence. It's true, you don't from them, but you do from yourself more than you needed it from your parents. There's an Ramban. So we think about how much we needed our encouragement from our parents, how much we needed their love, how much we needed their support. We need it from ourselves even more. That sense of, I'm so proud of what you're accomplishing, I love what you're doing, I love being married to you, and I'm excited. It's all of those things. That emotional support, we actually look to ourselves more than we did as children to our parents. And that is a very powerful concept. Very powerful. Because that's why, when we feel that support threatened, like, you don't really care about whatever that I'm doing, or you're not proud of me, or you think I'm doing something wrong, it's that tightrope that starts quivering, and we don't know what to do with that. It's a frightening experience. I feel alone, I feel threatened, I feel fear because of that. Which is why we make the mistake, and I say, you like the cholent, and it becomes personal. And I don't like the cholent at all. And every husband's afraid of his wife's response when he says that. Why is he so afraid? Like, why wouldn't he just take it? Like, if a buddy of mine asked me that, and he made, you know, we're at a barbecue, and he said, you like the barbecue? I said, no, I don't like it. It's not for me. Like, I'm not afraid. He's like, we're not friends with you. I have no fear of that. I'm not afraid of telling him the truth, because there's nothing at stake. But all of a sudden, marriage, it's as if there's so much more at stake than the beef. But why? Because in the big picture there is, and we sometimes make mistakes and we put it in the wrong place. So it's just something to be aware of.
Oh, you made a comment.
Yeah.
You said when marriage is in trouble, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So sometimes I think maybe you think that, you know, when things go wrong, like you just mentioned, that woman who was younger, we think immediately that we're in trouble. But are we in trouble?
No.
How does one know whether or not their marriage is in trouble?
When you're in trouble, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you're in doghouse trouble. I mean, it's like, how do you know when it's a real
These are everyday kinds. That's what we're discussing. These are everyday kinds of things that we can tap. And the question is working them through, understanding what's going on, and not misinterpreting that which is not there for that which is there. Okay, this is. I'm going to try something that I've never tried before. You'll tell me how I do. This is the thing from Tamima High School. I'm so glad that Mrs. Golding is here to see this, because this is all a credit to you. I've never tried this on my own. Is there an extra one? I didn't keep one for myself. Where's the file? Okay, the next part, I first came across, this I've come across, Virginia Satir came up with these four, she called stress styles of communication. I came across this in the sense that in a marriage workshop I took in New York this past summer that I'd like to adapt for us. So there are four basic stress styles of communications according to Virginia Satir, which is addressed over here. We're going to go through them quickly, and then I want to make them a little bit more real. On page 17, let's take a look at that one first. We'll see the four things on the top of the page. Placator, blamer, computer, and distractor. Okay, so what I want to do at this point is, now let's get into the nitty-gritty of how do we handle these different situations. How are we going to address when issues come up in our homes, in our marriages, that we can address them healthily in a way that we continue to grow in them. So there are four basic approaches as we're going to start to how we handle a stressful situation. Number one is the placator, camping out himself, the blame. Let me get right to making this real. You can see this on two space and like whatever, you flip the page, you forget about it. So I'd like to do this with Ricky, who's not available to come here tonight, so I'm going to do it by myself. In order to make this real, I would actually like to demonstrate what this will look like, so that when you see me doing it, you'll say to yourself, or to yourself if you're ripping him and I'm not looking, you can say, that's, or that's me. Now, for the bad ones, don't do that yourself, but if it's not better, you can do it. But to read this won't mean very much, but I want to show you what it actually looks like. And never before done, I'm going to do this all by myself, act out the following scene, and then you'll see how these things work out and why it's so significant to actually see them, because once you see them, you will see how it will impact your marriage. So, nice camera action. Here we go. So I'm going to pretend. Let's just pretend that this is Risky over here. He's actually in the kitchen doing something. I walk into the house. I need to angle out. It's going to be hard for me to pretend you guys understand you're not married. You'll tell me how I'm doing. Hi. Yeah. I am actually very excited. I just have to express myself. So I'm going to try to act out one side. I mean, I'm not going to act at her side, but it'll be obvious what it is that she's saying, which is really not so important to the conversation. Yeah, I'm so excited. I just spoke again with Hillel. Remember I told you we're having this reunion from my year that I spent in Israel. It's almost 20 years ago already. And we're getting together for the reunion, and they're doing it here in Atlanta. Yeah, I know it's crazy. They do it every year in New York or Chicago or L.A., and they realize that every year they get the same crowd. They get all the New Yorkers in New York. They get all the people from Chicago. So they wanted to try something different. Yeah, they're coming here to Atlanta, so I've been speaking with them. It's going to be amazing. People are coming with their spouses. I'm so excited to bring you and introduce you to everybody. I haven't seen these guys in over 20 years. Yeah, it's going to be amazing. What are you also looking like about to tell me something? Really? Your students bought you that? Tickets to a show? That's so cute. Well, for the two of us, that we should go together. They feel we don't spend enough time together. Oh, that's very sweet. That's exciting. I know you said, yeah, we're going to go. And a dinner to one of a good friend's special once-in-a-month steak nights. So they bought that for us to be able to go together. Absolutely fabulous. That's a very sweet thing. I can't wait to go. Let me just put it in my calendar. When is that? Sunday. Sure, the 21st. Sunday the 21st. What time is the show? 3 o'clock? 3 o'clock. 2:30. No, nothing's wrong. Nothing's wrong. No, it's fine. No, it's fine, really. It's fine. No, I think we should go to the show. Yeah. No, I don't mind. Really. Thanks, no, really. It's fine. I'm gonna go to the next reunion that they have here in Atlanta. No, I'm not upset at all. I think this is what we should do. No, really, for sure, this is what we should do without a question. I know you're so excited. It's going to be great. Now, how was that? So, right, so that's what it actually looks like. Because we have your conflict. I have an event on Sunday at 2:30 to 5:30. I'm very excited to go. We discover, not because of any fault of hers, that we have another thing to be at. Your students bought her a ticket to a show that's at 3 o'clock. Now, I think that's if I would have done the whole thing, I would have come in. My thing is downtown by the airport. That's downtown. Everybody's flying in. At the airport, the show's up in Marietta. Show's at 3 o'clock. My thing's from 2:30 to 5:30. People flying in. And it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So the placator is one who's done. No, that's fine. Totally fine. We'll do whatever it is that needs to be done. No problem. Now, it sounds very sweet. Now, when I first read this, that sounds like a good need. If I was giving a schmooze about being stuck, what's really the problem with this? Correct. Exactly. You think you're being a tzaddik, and you are being a tzaddik. Except the way that you're being a tzaddik is completely nullifying yourself. That, I mean, this is a big thing. This has been 20 years. You're really excited about it. You've been working on it. You're on the planning committee. And you're just going to say, like, no, it's fine. Not really, really. You will come through next. What's going to happen if you do this? What will happen at 3 o'clock while you're sitting at this show in Marietta?
Steam.
Steam. That's right. Now this is very significant because many, many people think that when they have a conflict, they're going to be righteous. They're going to be a tzaddik and they're going to say, no problem. I'm about there. I'll give in. Whatever, I'll play it. Yeah, no, it's fine. The problem is, if you're really a tzaddik, it's fine. But if you're playing the role on television, you are going to be a misery at this show. You're going to be a misery the whole damn Sunday. You're going to be a misery Sunday night. And what you were purposely trying to do is to give your wife, this is the night, this is our night together, is going to be a disaster. Yes?
Especially if you have a cat at some point during the after the 3 o'clock.
Right.
You're already seeing it.
Oh, totally.
And then it's just, yeah, it's 4 or 3.
So this is very important. As much as being a placate you think is righteousness, and in a way it is, but in a relationship it doesn't work. Because the resentment is so palpable. I mean, you can hear it. I think this is my first time performing this, but you can hear it, like, it's not going to work. And it's a joke to think it will, even though we get caught in that trap of trying to do that. Now, the other response that I have, which is unfortunately more common, I'd like to think, I don't assume we're all righteous, and we all go with the placator route. The second approach, that of being the blamer, ends up coming out as sounding more like, so good, let me just plug that in. What time is that? Sunday, 21st. Don't you remember I sent you the email? We've been discussing this reunion for 3 weeks already. I know they pointed, you just took it from them, you didn't stop them and ask? You never asked, why wouldn't you ask what time it was before doing that? No, I'm not angry. I'm not frustrated at all. I just don't understand why you would do that without asking me first. That's the other way that would work, in terms of being the blamer, the aggressor, in which the person, was there a mistake made over here somewhere along the way? Something happened. So when it's the total opposite, in which I completely nullify the other person's needs, desire, it's just, how can you possibly have done that? And I'm right. I put it on the calendar first. So at the end of the day, you made a mistake, you'll pay the consequences, because I'm not being angry about it. This is just what should happen. That's what should happen. Now, the computer is the third approach, which is mostly men, but not exclusively. That would sound something along the lines of, so when it's Sunday, what time is the show? 3 o'clock. Uh-huh. So you know that I have this reunion at 2:30. I know, it's going to be a little bit of a problem. It's not a problem. This is what we're going to do. We're going to go to the reunion at 2:30. We're going to leave at 2:42, and we're going to go to the show. We're going to get there a little bit late, older than Marietta. We're going to get there at 3. I figure probably about 3:33. We'll see about 23 minutes of the show, and then we're going to go out to dinner, and we're going to have a great time. You can't, like, that doesn't work, but there's an approach of, we have a problem, so let's just take all of the emotion out of the equation. Let's take all of the significance of whether it's a show versus a 20-year reunion, like, none of that matters. We're going to figure out how this is going to work, and it's just going to be like computer style. This is how it happens. We're going to do that, and if someone would look at this and they say, you're not making anything out of that. Nope, this is what happened, this is what we're going to do, end of the story. Which obviously doesn't work for either party in the same way. And a distractor, which you can just imagine, is where, like, once you realize the problem becomes something along the lines of, oh, this is going to be like a real problem. Did I tell you what happened at work today? And then you end up having this whole other discussion in which, like, no, we really need to discuss this. And you just refuse to, you know, one of the two is like wanting or trying to have a discussion. You know, you have those discussions, and just, I really need somebody else to do with me, where, like, you keep bringing it up, and you get started in the conversation, and then you're like, wait a minute, how did they end up getting to this? Like, we're trying to have this conversation, and someone's just not comfortable doing it, not comfortable getting involved, not comfortable having the conversation. All four of these ways that she writes and discusses, these are just simply approaches. I'm imagining that as you just see them, like, when you read it on a paper, maybe it makes sense to you. When you see a little bit what it looks like, you say, like, this happens. This is what happens. One of the two of us regularly responds in one of these ways. It's a natural response of, I'm always the placator. And I, therefore, I'm always filled with resentment. Because I feel like I'm always giving in, and I don't like it. Even though I'm trying to be so righteous about it, at the end of the day, it doesn't really work because of that fact. Or any of the others. What really needs to happen is what she calls the leveler, which is being able to have that discussion, which is going to be the last couple minutes for tonight, and then all of tomorrow is, okay, so now that I have a sense of what sometimes happens, which is not productive, how then do we have this conversation? We have a problem here. There's a conflict. You really want to go to the show. You really want to spend this time together with the two of us. Your students bought you the gift. It's non-refundable. And I really want to be at my reunion. How do we address this? And that's a simple example. In life, in our marriages, we have much more significant, sensitive issues than that. How do we go about doing that? So let's get started. Let's get started with that. Okay. My colossal mistake was doing this on a Tuesday because Dale Becker was off on Tuesday, so I had to do this. So there were cuts on even, and not on the right kinds of paper. I had to do this all myself. You'll excuse the unprofessional look.
Yeah.
Sue Johnson. Okay. You got two. They're not for you. You got two.
You mentioned that the next part is tomorrow.
No, next is that. Okay, the next part is based on John Gottman, who I'm sure many of you have heard. I like to talk about him a lot. He wrote a book called The Seven Principles That Make a Marriage Work. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. He's a firm psychologist who lives in Seattle. And he's a researcher. So his books on marriage are not based on his clinical experiences, but on actual research which he has done, and I like to cut and paste from different things that he writes in his book. So he discusses the concept where he has solvable versus unsolvable problems. Some of our problems, he actually has a number, because he's a researcher, so he pays attention to these and comes up with numbers. He actually claims, from all his research that he does, that 69% of 70% of fights, disputes, conflicts that couples have are what he calls unsolvable. They're perpetual conflicts. They will never be solved. It's just, like, you're like this, and I'm like this. Like, let's go back to what I spoke about earlier. My wife and I will never, ever, ever, ever solve the dinner problem of going to shul or school dinners. I will always want to leave earlier than her. She will always want to stay later. There is no resolution. It's only a matter of how we handle it. But we would not talk about that in terms of conflict resolution. There's no resolution to this issue. She likes to talk. I like to be by myself. That's just the way that it is. We will always be that way. He claims 70%, like temperature is a great one. Like, I like the house to be 72, you like it to be 68. It'll always be that way. Maybe like when you turn 50, like your body will change and you'll like the temperature different. But then your spouse will also turn 50 and she'll like a different model. It's always going to be, there's no like resolution. There's no like, okay, let's solve this problem, let's this problem. How are we going to have, there's no resolution. It's always going to be that way. And then we have more acute issues or specific issues, like which school should we send our child to? You want this, I want that. There's going to be an answer to this problem. The child's going to go to a school, and we need to figure out which one and how we're going to handle it. Or other issues that we have that are not what we would call perpetual, there's a way to heal that's actually 70%. When we're addressing, so just, I throw that in just to be aware, sometimes when you're having an issue, like try to think, like, are we going to be talking about this for the next 50 years? Because if we are, then we can handle it totally differently than we're doing now. Because if this is never going to change, it's just the way that we are, then we accept it and we move on. But within the solvable issues, so he has what he considers four steps to deal with it, which will deal with step number one right now. And that's what he calls the harsh setup. You have two sides of your page, the harsh setup or the soft setup. This issue kills most issues that we have, most conflict where we need to address, and is killed before it even gets started. And the destruction comes from the way it starts. It started in a way in which it's over before it has a chance to begin. Just an anecdote to address this issue. I like to bring the example of a soda bottle. Soda bottle, the reason why we like soda, one of the reasons is because it has bubbles in it. If you like the carbonation, for whatever reason. And a soda bottle that's flat is really not interesting to us. You like to have it be filled with its fizz. But the problem with it is if you shake it up, so then that which is really the good stuff is a little bit too much, and the pressure builds. And what happens if you open it up without knowing that it's already been shaken up? Right? It creates a mess. Now, does it matter who shook that bottle up when you're holding it in your hand about to open it?
No.
I don't care how it was shaken. I don't care if your three-year-old dropped it or your brother was playing a practical joke on you. If the bottle has been shaken up, when you open it, you're going to get messy. So our emotions are very often, we can visualize like the fizz in the soda bottle. We like it. It's good. It's the spice of life. Like somebody who's totally flat, they're not so much fun to be around. We are filled with the carbonation. But sometimes we get all shaken up. And in a closed, tight bottle, shake, 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 and then someone's going to open it. And whoever opens that, they're going to get in trouble. And it doesn't matter who shook it up. Doesn't matter whether I was at work, or it was the kids, or whatever. When you open up that bottle, you're going to be in trouble. When I was in the Borough Park, for those who are familiar with 13th Avenue, so it was past summer, the Ripley wanted to take my oldest daughter shopping, and I had the other five kids. I'm going to be the hero. When you go shopping, I'll manage the kids, no problem. So we parked right by a meter, right by 13th Avenue, and there's an ice cream shop right across the street. I'm going to take them. I'm going to manage. You do your thing. Put a couple quarters in. We head up across the street. And it was one of those days where, like, you name it, as we get in, the three-year-old has to go to the bathroom, and the door was locked, and then the baby's running all over the place, and a camp, right as we walk in, a camp of 40 girls walks into the ice cream shop right before we walk in. So it's total bedlam. There's nowhere to sit. Kids are out of control. And I manage the situation because I'm a hero. And 20 minutes go by, and everyone's been fed. Everyone's fine. And we walk out of the store, and I see there's 10 minutes left. I know on my meter. But as I realize, right as I walk out, the store right next door is an electronics store and something that I needed. 10 minutes, there's no way anyone's going to come to the car. I can't take the kids all the way across the street and then come back to go to this electronics. I need one little thing. I run all five kids to the electronics store, which is because you haven't been in Borough Park. Nothing is 10 minutes in Borough Park. I get out of there. Just about 10 minutes later, we're waiting to cross the street, and the parking meter guy is walking up to my car. So I'm like, I got a baby, four other kids, and I want to dash across 13th Avenue because to tell them that I'm right there. I got to wait for the light. I got to drag everybody. I'm totally stressed about the whole thing. I get there, and he's filling it out. And I say, I'm here. I'm putting clothes in. He says, it's lit. I started riding it. Like, oh, come on. You know, my kids don't know that he's a traffic cop, and all he's doing is giving me a $35 fine. The older ones, who 17, have been taken off the jail. He starts losing it. It's crazy. As you can imagine the scene, I'm holding an 8-month-old, my 3-year-old, and my 8-year-old thinks I'm being taken away to go to. It's craziness. And at that moment, my phone rings, and my wife is there, checking in to see how things are going. Pick up the phone, and what do you think happens to her when she says, just call to see how it's going? It's like a total explosion. And like coming out of nowhere. Like, I can't believe you on shop because you left me alone. Oh, my God. You know, 10 minutes before I was fine, but walking out there between the electronics store, and the next 10 minutes, like, my whole life's all marked. And she called at that moment. So in her world, what's that? Yeah, well, no, because I wanted her to know how crazy it was. So from her, so she, I think it's fine. All of a sudden, she gets like, you know, the whole thing like blew up. Like, what should I do? Should I come out? I was like, no, I'm fine. I'm like all frazzled with what you were talking about. So that happens in life. We get shaken up. And then the next person who opens the bottle gets really wet. And it's not their fault. So we need to know, A, two things. So when you know that a bottle's full and your 3-year-old threw it on the floor, you can do two things with it. Either you leave it on a shelf for a week, or you know how to very skillfully open it. So when we know that our spouse has been all shaken up, we can either leave her on the shelf for a week and walk away. I don't recommend that. I've tried. It doesn't work. It does not work at all. Or you know how to very skillfully open it and how to diffuse that. Now, those of us who don't know how to do that in marriage, because that's what people are, how to take somebody who's all wound up and diffuse that, we need to know ourselves when we're like that and we explode on our spouse to be able to say, just like you could say, honey in the chillings, you can say, soda bottle, sorry, that's not you. And we need to be able to hear that and say it when that happens, because it happens all the time where we come home, we have a stressful situation somewhere else, and we literally vomit on our spouses. And it's not their fault. They didn't do anything, but we are so shaken up that it happens. That it's an important thing to be aware of, and that happens in the harsh setup, because when we have something important to talk about, something bothering us, what normally happens is we let it sit. When the stigma on Tona is where something else causes us to be all shaken up. But what happens in our marriage is our spouse is doing something which is really hurting us. We don't want to say anything. I'm not going to say anything. And then it happens again. I'm not going to say anything. I'm a tzaddik. I've been to marriage seminars. I am not going to let this bother me. And then it happens again. And you begin to think, maybe I'm not such a tzaddik. No, I am a tzaddik, you say to yourself. And then it happens again. And by the time you discover that you're really not a tzaddik, it's way too late because you are so wound up that when you bring it up, it is not being brought up in a sense of someone, I'd really like to talk to you about something. That's not what happens. What happens is it happens the fifth time, and boom, you are like, you're all over it. I know, like, the person who's like here, like, I understand, like, where is this coming from? That conversation will not end well. I've tried it, it doesn't. There is no good solution to that because it started so poorly with so much heat that you can't resolve it because it doesn't work that way. And so the key, step one of what we'll talk about, we'll just do these four things tonight. Step one is a soft startup. If you look in the back to the side, it says soft startup. Three basic approaches, and then we'll do the activities on the other side. Number one is invite the conversation. When you have something you want to discuss, there's an issue, whatever it may be, you have to issue an invitation. Is now a good time to talk? I'd like to talk about a certain issue. When is a good time? That creates an entirely, it's the simplest tool, the simplest word, that completely changed the way the conversation will go in the sense of, no, I actually can't do it now, but let's make time tonight, or tomorrow, or whenever, or now is a good time, but now I'm prepared. We're going to have a conversation, and it's not while I'm in the middle of getting dinner at the table, and all of a sudden it says, I really don't like it when you're like, I can't handle that. And usually it comes out wrong, it's not received well. So number one is simply inviting the conversation. Dealing with the complaint without blame and dealing with the I sentences is number one. I'm sure that's a common thing that's spoken about in these types of things. I need you to listen to me when you're talking as opposed to, you're not going to listen to me when I'm talking to you. So that also usually isn't, that's not heard. How do we respond when someone says something like that to me? Defense. That's not true. Of course I do. Or I'll counter with something. But you just keep it in the I aspect of this is what I need. This is what I experience. And describe clearly what you need without evaluating or judging. The baby needs to be changed and fed as opposed to you never help out with the baby or well, you're never living. Those don't go very well. Just describe clearly. I want to move your stuff. I appreciate if you clean your stuff off the kitchen table. Is far more valuable. Flip to the other side. Go through these four. I realized as I'm going through, like I had you doing very little activities, which I really wanted to do more, and that's the way it went out. That's why you're my guinea pig group. But here we'll do one. Go through the four. Well, by 9:15 we'll be over. For those of you who need to leave, you're leaving now. It's fine also. Four different scenarios, and you can take turns in one each. In terms of, I gave you the example of what the harsh startup would be, and just physically practice, literally, what would the word sound like? If this is the conversation you needed to have, how would you start that conversation? Take 3 minutes just to go through them. Okay, I'm gonna cut this short, even though I'm sure you guys are having a lot of fun, but I want to get you out of here, and I want to talk about one or two more things quickly. Step number, I hope, if there's anything you walk out with, is this. If you work on when there's a conversation that has to happen, keep in your mind, harsh startup versus soft startup, you'll see that things will go very different. Well, the next step is the key, what John Gottman refers to as repair attempts. Now, repair attempts are when a conversation is going on, and either it was started poorly, or it started off well, but it got heated, and it's getting intense. So what happens physiologically, many, many books I've written, there's a book that I got in graduate school, it's called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And it's a very cute title. And why is it that you think zebras don't get ulcers? They don't get married. That's one answer. the basic answer is because when zebras are put in stressful situations, like all animals, they're in a fight or flight situation. They either fight it out or zebras more often run from them. And the whole book was based on the fact that we humans have evolved into a society in which we also get involved in very stressful situations. I mean, the adrenal glands which begin pumping adrenaline into all sorts of parts of our body. Blood is being directed away from our brains into our muscles. And what do we need to do? sit and have a conversation. And we have no tools. We're like a monkey. We have the brain capacity of a monkey. All of the blood has left our brain. Our muscles are bulging. And we're supposed to be caught in front of a computer writing a rational email. It's a complete failure, which is why we get ulcers, because our bodies are like are being all pumped up as our heartbeat begins to race. And we need to be using rational thought processes when our bodies are getting us ready for non-rational type of event. So Gottman, with that one, the whole thing basically says there's what's called repair attempts. As the conversation escalates and you feel it beginning to tense up, very often what will happen is one of the two parties will make an attempt to de-escalate. It will be done sometimes as a joke, crack a joke. Or you'll say something overt by saying, we need to take some time, or this is too heated, I'm not comfortable, whatever it may be. Sometimes it's as cute as one couple. When a marriage is going well, the repair time can be as silly as, you know, one person saying like, and like also like, it just de-escalates. The key thing here is in being able to make and receive a repair attempt. When you're getting in the heat of the moment and someone cracks a joke, what they're trying to do, whether or not they're aware of it or not, is say, like, we need to scale back. We can't be productive in this manner as this is going. And what happens is someone will do something to, like, de-escalate, and the other party will come in and smash it down and say, like, there you go again, making jokes in the title of a serious conversation. But they're not trying to be funny. They're instinctively trying to say, like, this isn't working. I can't function like this. So some of us, especially now that you've heard this, you'll go home and you'll say it overtly. You'll say, I can't talk like this. We need to take a break. And if they repair, they're like, you're right, this isn't going to go well. Let's calm down and start again in 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Sometimes you need 20 minutes. Or in the middle of a conversation, it's just a reminder that says we're going in the wrong direction. And every couple can develop, you know, again, as I said, sometimes it's like mimicking your four-year-old. And you know, you can do the body language that your four-year-old does when she gets frustrated, or you can just say like, we need to calm down. Whatever it may be, there are repair attempts which are made. Sometimes they're in the argument that's made in which the person says, well, it's really not so bad. It is so bad. No. We're trying to de-escalate and start over. And you have to be able to receive those. You have to be aware that it's there, so that when it's being made by one of the two partners, to be able to say, yes, you're right. We can't talk this way. It's not going to be able to happen. The last things that he discusses, I'll just mention very briefly, and I'll send you home. The next two steps I'll mention, really that's going to be the work that we're going to do next week in Merit Hashem, is once we have a conversation that started in the right way, once along the way we're able to make adjustments, slight adjustments along the path that says, like, we're veering off, this isn't going to work, and then being able to work into compromise, being aware of that is the key element in being able to work these things out, which is a simple word, which we're not going to get into now. It's too much for right now. And lastly, just mention accepting each other's faults. As we're going along in this discussion, we each have our own personality quirks. We have things that we like and don't like, and our job is not to fix each other. We have an issue at hand, which we're going to have to discuss, and I need to accept the way that you are in certain areas as we begin to discuss them. Right now, that's just words. I'll leave you with that for now. Next week, Mirat Hashem, I want to get into the nitty-gritty of actually having one of those conversations. So what you could do over the course of the week is pay attention to that conversation that you've either been avoiding or had that didn't go well. And you could, I don't need to know that, and you'll talk about it amongst yourselves. But next week, we'll actually work through how do we have a conversation that was called a crucial conversation. It's going to be intense. It's going to be significant. It's important. And that we can have it in a way that we both feel safe and comfortable, and we're able to figure out what we need to figure out in a way that we feel closer to each other as we go along through the process and not being pushed farther apart. Okay, so what I leave you with for tonight are the following concepts, just as quick review that what my goal is that you walk out of there with the introvert, extrovert words, that you're able to use those terminologies when you need them to define and describe how you are feeling, that you have the phrase of honey in the chillin. When there are issues which are simply a matter of taste that you do like or don't like, that you're able to describe without feeling personally offended or on the ropes as it's being discussed, pay attention to the emotional bonds, the concept of how critically we feel we need to have the support of each other, how important it is to us, and you can express that. I need your support. To be able to say that, to go over the four stress styles, of the placator, blamer, computer, distractor. Like, how does that fit into your discussions? And when you see one of the other ones doing it, say, wait a minute, we have an issue. You're just placating right now. You're going to resent me for the next year if I go along with this. We actually need to have a discussion about it, not so fast. Or to say, wait a minute, I'm feeling blamed. Just chill out. We need to talk about this. You have those terminologies in your head. And the soda bottle example, when you feel like your spouse just like exploded upon you, you have that terminology. And the soft startup and making with these repair times. Those are the things that we discussed. That's it for this week. Mr. Shem, next week we'll get some of the nitty-gritties of the conversations to be able to have. And I hope you'll welcome back. And if you don't, I won't take it personally. Okay, that's it. Have a good night, all.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.